Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the United Nations, where world heads of state are gathering for what is expected to be a session dominated by the question of Palestinian statehood. Veteran UN correspondent Ian Williams joins us. He covers the UN for Foreign Policy in Focus. Then we'll look into the state of disillusionment amongst progressives when it comes to supporting President Obama's re-election in 2012. Mike Lux, the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies, who was formerly a special assistant to President Clinton for public liaison in the White House, joins us to discuss the possibility of primary challenges and how the president can win back his disaffected base. Then finally, with two theocratic candidates running for president, Rick Perry and Michelle Bachmann, we will analyze the results of American theocracy in terms of life in the red states dominated by the religious right. Stephen Schwartz, senior fellow at the Samueli Institute, joins us. He has an article in the science journal Explore, The Rise of American Theocracy, Implications for Science and Healthcare. Joining us now is Ian Williams, who is a veteran journalist who has covered the UN for decades. He is an author as well as a senior analyst for Foreign Policy in Focus. He writes for Salon and Alternet, among others, and is the author of a number of books, including The UN for Beginners and Deserter, George W. Bush's War on Military Families, Veterans and His Past, and Rum, A Social and Sociable History. His blog is Deadline Pundit. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ian Williams.
Good to talk to you, Ian.
And this week at the United Nations, of course, is when the world leaders gather, and clearly this week or the following weeks are going to be dominated by the question of statehood for Palestine. And clearly there's some frantic maneuvering going on to head that off, to head off an inevitable veto by the United States, which would be deeply embarrassing for the United States. Where does that stand at the moment?
It's difficult to tell. It was interesting in President Obama's speech. He didn't actually directly mention any type of threat or veto. He did remind people, he might have maintained a discreet silence, but other people noticed. But, of course, 12 months ago, he got up there and said he looked forward to welcoming a Palestinian state within 12 months, which makes the U.S. embarrassment even more complete, because it is totally irrational. I think a lot of people wonder why the Palestinians started on this, but obviously a lot of Palestinians think it was an attempt by the Abbas and the Palestinian Authority to show some signs of progress. But obviously they've touched on some raw nerves, certainly in Israel, and the Kudniks and Netanyahu are pulling the strings on Obama in an unprecedented way. And I think I know the sort of complex of reasons behind it. But one thing is for sure is that this has no direct interest for the United States whatsoever. This veto, or even the threat of a veto, and the brouhaha that's gone on so far, has alienated even further Turkey, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, all of the other regional powers. It has sort of removed any, residual enthusiasm that the Arab masses of the Arab Spring might have had for the United States as an honest broker in all of this. And it's profoundly embarrassed the Obama administration because even if people in Europe actually do follow instructions, they're very embarrassed. They realize that they're pulling his irons out of the fire. This is a complete self-inflicted wound for the Obama administration. He could have turned around to Netanyahu and said, hey, you didn't do what we asked you to. Why should we do this for you now?
Well, presumably, with an election year coming up, the president simply doesn't want to pick a fight with Israel and be the subject of an attack by the Israel lobby. The New York Times on Wednesday has a front-page story talking about how Netanyahu's influence is so great in the Congress that the president has to turn to Netanyahu to help him with the Congress.
Well, we saw that when Netanyahu addressed Congress. I mean, it was one of the most disgustingly slavish displays ever. He got more standing ovations than Joseph Stalin on an average speech. It was just unprecedented. And there is this fear of the Israel lobby, which is sort of tacitly trying to claim the credit for the Republican upset in the New York special election last week, which produced Republican Bill Turner to replace Anthony Weiner. But, you know, if you look down in the numbers there, there are far more issues there than Israel behind it. And with a very few exceptions, any president that actually got up and said, look, I don't think we should be giving $5 billion of our hard-earned taxpayers' money to another country that continually cocks the snookers, I think that would be a huge winning program, frankly.
Short of that, which is highly unlikely, at least if the president were to take a pro-Palestinian state stand, you know, you probably noticed, Ian Williams, the recent op-ed in the New York Times by the former Saudi ambassador, former head of intelligence, Prince Turkey, warning the U.S. that it will dissipate what little credibility it has left in the Arab world. I mean, I take it that you explain to me, why are the reasons, apart from the influence of Israel over domestic politics in an election year, what are the other reasons why the U.S. has to take this position? Because, you know, ironically, it's somewhat similar to what the Israelis found themselves in before they were a state back in 1948.
Well, I don't think there's any rational reason for the U.S. apart from doing what Netanyahu wants. And there are many people in Israel who sort of have pointed out, look, Obama says he wants a two-state solution with a Palestinian state. The Quartet has said they want a two-state solution with a Palestinian state. The UN has said that they want a two-state solution. And even Netanyahu has said he wants a Palestinian state. He doesn't really. He wants a Palestinian state like he wants lung cancer. We all know that, but he has to say this for international diplomacy. And so you've got a whole complex of reasons. In Israel and in the U.S., the people who are really deeply opposed to this are people who do not want a Palestinian state, don't accept that the Palestinians have any rights at all within mandatory Palestine in any part of it, and would just assume they all went away. They're just going along for public relations purposes. And, you know, in that context, it's interesting that the people who turned out in who voted against the Democrats in the election here, they might have done it for Israel, but these are included an unhealthily high proportion of people who think that Obama is a Muslim infiltrator without an American birth certificate and similar kooky notions. They're not representative of mainstream American Jewish opinion, let alone American public opinion. And by pandering to Netanyahu, in fact, Obama is sort of is pandering to some of his worst and kookiest enemies on the home front. It makes it even more puzzling why he would do this or why it would be considered a rational thing to do.
Again, I'm speaking with Ian Williams, who is a veteran journalist who has covered the United Nations for 4 decades. He is a senior analyst at Foreign Policy in Focus, and you write for Salon and Alternet, and we're talking about what's happening at the UN this week, dominated as it will be by the question of Palestinian statehood. I recently interviewed David Miller, who served 6 secretaries of state and was President Clinton's Mideast negotiator. He has a piece in Foreign Policy called Humpty Dumpty Palestine, pointing out that Palestine is divided and decentralized and dysfunctional. And you mentioned earlier that criticism coming from Palestinians themselves is that this is a power grab by Abbas, since his rivals in Gaza, Hamas, don't seem to be a part of the deal. So what about the idea of a Palestinian state when the Palestinians are so divided?
This is what makes it all so much more ridiculous. The United States insisted that the Khmer Rouge government that had been driven out of Cambodia and lived in a few jungle camps on the Thai border be continued for many years to be recognized as the legitimate government of Cambodia in the U.S. We have recognized the Transitional Revolutionary Council, Transitional National Council in Libya as a legitimate government, when huge swathes of territory are still under the hands of Gaddafi. And I think you alluded earlier, is that when Israel was accepted into the United Nations, it did not have accepted fronting. In fact, it still doesn't. There was an armistice line, which it promised to respect, but the only sort of international legal frontiers as established were of the partition resolution before, well, in which case most of Galilee would be joining the West Bank in the Arab state. the Palestinians have, in a rare concession to reality, have actually ducked on that one. But, you know, all of this, almost every argument that has been thrown up against the Palestinian state flies directly in the face of previous U.S. policy when it was expedient. We are now calling for the recognition of Kosovo, and I accept that. But the Kosovo authorities in Pristina have only a tenuous hold on the territory north of Mitrovica. And you know, there is strong opposition there. So, you know, we're calling for... There is no consistency here. And, of course, there is only one reason, is that this, I think, much overrated fear of the power of the Israel lobby.
So, in terms of tactics on the part of the Palestinians, you hear one day that they're going to go to the Security Council and the next day that they're going to go to the General Assembly. Obviously, if they go to the General Assembly, they would get a majority vote, and that would be embarrassing to the U.S. when it eventually came to the veto. What's your understanding of their tactics?
Well, Nabil Sharpe, who's been a long-standing sort of PLO spokesperson, gave a press conference today, and each time there are more details, because obviously they're keeping their negotiating room wide open. They haven't committed themselves, and what he's indicating is that they won't go to the General Assembly and the Security Council simultaneously. They'll go to the, they'll put the application in the Security Council, which will then refer it to a special committee to look at. So this is going to keep the threat of a self-inflicted veto hovering over the Obama administration for many weeks to come. And following that is the threat that if you do veto it, then this then becomes an issue that is that under, once again, an American resolution introduced to combat Soviet vetoes during the Korean War, the Uniting for Peace resolution. They will ask for a reconvening of a special General Assembly to consider their request for an enhanced status. And, you know, in the 90s, the Palestinian mission had a very clear strategy of reinforcing international law and their position. So the Palestine mission to the UN can already speak, can already attend meetings. It doesn't have to be specially invited. It has all of the prerogatives of the state except the vote. And so, you know, this is, they're adding to this. And the key part, which I think really frightens some Israelis, at least in a irrational way, is the idea that if Palestine is accepted as a state by the General Assembly, then that will then give the go-ahead for the parties to the International Convention, the International Criminal Court, to accept a Palestinian signature. The significance there is that if Palestine is accepted as a state and its 1967 boundaries, the West Bank and Gaza, are accepted, then that means that crimes committed in that territory can be referred to the International Criminal Court. And, of course, there is one group of people who, by world repute, have been committing crimes in the occupied territories. So that is something that is a sort of potent scaring factor for the Israelis, and justifiably so, since they are committing crimes, and already under universal jurisdiction, a lot of Israeli military and civil leaders have to check with their lawyers and their travel agents simultaneously when they go anywhere.
But what about the fact that you've got the West Bank, whose leadership are pushing statehood, and you've got Hamas, which is in Gaza, a separate entity almost. The Egyptians try to stitch them back together again, but they're not even joined territorially. So what's this statehood declaration going to do for real unity within the Palestinians?
Well, it's not going to do that much unless it provides some wiggle room. But I think one of the points is, ever since Clinton, the U.S. has said that these issues have to be solved by bilateral negotiation between Israel and the Palestinians, including statehood. And this is inherently unfair. It's like putting a toddler and a sumo wrestler in an arena and saying, okay, the sumo wrestler stole your toy, now get it back off it. You know, there is international law here, and that's been implicitly accepted by Obama when he said that the settlement should be based on the 67 boundaries. You know, we're not talking about an open forum here. We're talking about something where rules are clearly written. Now, if it's accepted by everybody that the Palestinians have a claim to all of the a legitimate claim to all of those territories, then it obviously strengthens their hand. Even if it came to negotiating about land swaps, they're not going to say, "Oh yes, you can take away our biggest aquifers and our most fertile land, and give us a chunk of the Negev desert in return." You know, it does strengthen their hand legally, and that's what they want here. If they're accepted as a state, it strengthens their hand in negotiations immeasurably, because it's not a case of begging for favors from Israel. They're two sovereign states discussing, matters of contention. So in the end, that's one of the rational purposes behind the otherwise inexplicable insistence of Abbas on this move at the moment.
Well, just to change subjects, because obviously there are other things going on at the United Nations, Ian Williams, veteran journalist, has covered the UN for some time. Tell me what's going on with Ahmadinejad is coming over. Of course, he usually gets a lot of press, says outrageous things. I'm sure he says them deliberately to shore up his base at home. He got kind of insulted by the supreme leader on the eve of his departure, where he promised the release of these American hikers held hostage there, and wasn't able to deliver. So, what do you expect in terms of Ahmadinejad or any other fireworks in the coming weeks?
Well, it's an interesting contrast. Is the British Conservative government, or the coalition government, the British Foreign Minister met the Iranian Foreign Minister today and discussed mutual issues. And, you know, the difference is that, you know, the Europeans can actually go and talk to the Iranians and tell them what they think, whereas because of all of these domestic prohibitions, U.S. diplomats are reduced to shouting across the oceans at people and not having any direct negotiations. And incidentally, the British Foreign Minister took them to task for hanging a 17-year-old, for example. So it wasn't a case of pandering and sweetness and light. That there were serious issues to be broached there.
Well, the Iranians have just arrested six people, accusing them of working for the BBC, which apparently is a capital offence.
God help us all, yes. I've done work for the BBC myself. And, one of the points about Iran is that it's not a unitary state. It's not a dictatorship. There's lots of different power centres in there. And I think I've just seen a news report that the hitchhikers have actually been released. So in terms of a power struggle, if that were the case, then Ahmadinejad has sort of got the upper hand against the supreme leader. It's always difficult to tell on these things. But it is a lot more complex than you will get from the view you get from outside. I'm speaking to somebody who has no brief for religious for theocracies of any kind, it's more attached to reality than image when it comes to these issues.
So, just in closing, then, you don't expect anything else to be on the agenda but the Palestinian issue.
This is one of the problems: is this issue, and it's good for the Palestinians that they've done this. They managed to embarrass and get more negotiating with a room out of Clinton and Co. Ban Ki-moon's speech was very eloquent, and I think that Ban Ki-moon has been consistently misunderestimated. He is far more outspoken than his predecessors. His delivery mightn't be as rhetorical, it's not quite up to Martin Luther King standards, but he is pushing hard for measures to combat poverty. He's pushing for measures against climate change. All of these issues, he's pushing hard on, and his speech was overshadowed by Obama and the whole Middle East brouhaha. And, incidentally, Ban Ki-moon's position on the Middle East has changed considerably since he took office and he began to be exposed from the reality. Once again, he's far more outspoken about what Israel has to do than his predecessors ever were. He does not get credit for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you for joining us, Ian Williams. Thank you.
We should speak more often. It's been a while.
It has been a while, and I thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Ian Williams, who's a veteran journalist, covered the UN for some time. He writes also for, he's a senior analyst on foreign policy in Focus and writes for Salon and Alternet. His blog is Deadline Pundit. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about progressive discontent with Obama.